You're listening to the last episode of All the Best to be made in 2018. Don't worry, we'll be back next year. But in this freshie, we're mixing our words. It's a show all about language. In the mix are translations, tests, and a couple of tapes. First up, we're looking at English in the exam room.
Every year, tens of thousands of people from all around the world come to Australia. They come for many reasons, for work, for study, to start new lives. Greg Ortega was one of those people.
My name is Greg. I am from Venezuela and I've been living in Australia for about 10 years.
Greg moved to Melbourne when he was 18 to study at university. He got a bachelor's degree in IT, then stayed to complete his master's as well. At one point, he did what many other immigrants decide to do after living here for a while. He decided to apply for his permanent residency. Australia has a points-based system for granting permanent residency. If you want to be eligible, you need to reach a certain number of points. The points you get depend on different factors, like your age, your work, and your education level. But one thing you can do to increase your chances is to sit an English language test.
Did you feel confident before going into the exam?
Yes, I felt pretty confident. I was like, that's something I've been doing for a long time and, you know, why wouldn't I feel confident?
Greg certainly had reasons to feel confident. He had, after all, been living in Australia for almost a decade. He had studied at an Australian university and he had been working for Australian companies. So he booked an IELTS exam on a Saturday morning in 2016. IELTS is the International English Language Testing System, an exam created by Cambridge University and administered all around the world. Every year, more than 5 million people take the exam. Mostly, it's used to apply to universities and colleges. But some governments, like the Australian and Canadian ones, also use it as criteria for applying for residency. So, what's it like to do an IELTS exam?
Oh, it's a terrible experience. It makes you really nervous. It's very crowded. There is a bunch of people controlling the whole crowd, and it makes you feel very overwhelmed. And everyone is kind of like very, very strict and giving like straight orders at people. And it's just very, very uncomfortable, the whole thing.
Greg had sat exams at university before, but IELTS was different.
The stress level is much worse to take this exam. And I think it's because of the implications of the visa and all these things that come with it.
It's not a nice experience, to be honest.
That's Jay Marlowe, an English language teacher who founded a popular YouTube channel coaching students to pass different language tests, like IELTS.
So the first thing that you're expected to do is describe in written form various graphs.
Jay, an Australian native, decided to sit the IELTS exam himself. He wanted to show his students that the skills he was teaching them could help them pass the exam. Just like Greg, he booked a test and went into it feeling confident.
I sort of thought to myself, come on, I've had 32 years of speaking English, or at least, you know, the first 2 years listening to it. I thought I'll be fine. And yeah, didn't quite work out that way.
Now, the IELTS exam is a little bit different from other tests in that there is no real pass or fail mark. What you get is a band score from 1 to 9 for reading, listening, writing, and speaking. The score you need to get depends on what the test is being used for. To get into uni, you might need a 6 or a 6.5 average. To get the 20 points for the permanent residency, the score you usually need is much higher, an 8 for every single skill. And this is really tough to get. Only about 1 in 20 test takers get an 8 or higher. And that's what makes IELTS such a daunting exam, even for high-skilled graduates like Greg.
The weight and the price and the booking, it all piles up. And then you have to pass so that you can get your life together and apply for a visa or school or whatever. It's very stressful, the whole situation.
Greg failed his test. He only got 6.5 for writing. He then booked another test straight away, but he got 6.5 again.
That was the worst. That was like very, very frustrating. I just remember feeling like shit the whole time. It's like, this is not possible.
How did Jay do?
So I got my text message and I'd done almost perfect in reading and listening and speaking, and my writing score was 6.5 out of 9, which would not have allowed me to get into a graduate course at a university, for example. I think they call it like a proficient user of English, certainly not an expert user of English. So that was a shock.
So that's Jay, an English teacher born in Australia with a master's in applied linguistics, and he failed the test. After asking for it to be remarked, he still only got 7.5 in writing. He then chose to sit the exam again, and again. In the end, he had to approach IELTS directly to find out more about their scoring system, and on the fourth try, he finally got an 8.5. It didn't make sense to him.
I think this is what students go through as well, especially if you're a good user of English and you feel it's been unfair. I think I went through all the different emotional stages.
This feeling of unfairness is a common one about IELTS. Part of the problem with the exam is how mysterious and opaque it can seem. Once you get your results, all you have is your score. You are not given any comments or feedback, and you can't look back at your test paper. The score you get is also only valid for 2 years, so you might have to sit it multiple times, even if you've already passed it before. And then there's the effect it has on your mental well-being.
When you're bad at language, it says something about who you are. It's sort of, these tests are a kind of validation of your ability to communicate in the world, your ego. They're fundamentally connected to your ego. So when you fail these tests, it's very, very disturbing as to what it does to your self-confidence, self-esteem, belief in yourself, belief in your ability to participate in society, all this sort of stuff.
You start thinking, well, maybe if I don't pass this exam, then I have to consider other choices. I have to maybe go somewhere else. It can really affect the way you think. That's not good because it starts to affect your health.
All these negative effects on people's mental health have led some to question the use of these language tests in immigration.
If you can pass a university degree, why aren't you deemed qualified to live within society?
That's Helen Josevic. She's president of the Women's Friendship Group, a multicultural organization in Manningham. Helen has been lobbying and advocating for migrants, many of whom are highly educated but have struggled with the IELTS exam.
What is it meant for? Is it only for a professional person coming in? Is that all this country wants? When they have these professional degrees, they're still not able to pass.
Helen wants to highlight the negative effects of these tests on migrants, and to question why they are used for immigration in the first place. She also wonders why they're administered by private companies.
There are departments of education, federally and state-wise. Why can't they administer this test? Why is it put out to individual companies, which are huge profit-making entities?
Then there's the cost. Every time you sit the exam, it's $330.
So we've had lots and lots, hundreds, thousands of students who have failed these tests, not once, not twice, but multiple times. I think the record, I remember one guy from Pakistan who had failed 15 times over a 2-year period.
That would be almost $5,000 in test fees, not to mention all the stress and frustration.
I think there should be tests. I don't disagree with that in any way, shape or form. But I am looking at the reasons behind this type of test, the standard of this type of test, and the justice in this type of test.
Interestingly, even Greg agrees that there should be language tests.
Some kind of test to assess your level of English is good, but the way the exams are done and the whole experience is definitely not good. Like, I think there could be a better way to assess someone's ability to speak English and to communicate.
In the end, Greg did pass. Well, kinda. After failing IELTS 4 times, he sat a different exam, the PTE, which is done on a computer and is marked by algorithms. The PTE is becoming more popular and started being accepted by the Australian government in 2014. I asked Greg how it felt when he got his results back and he saw that he finally passed.
I was so happy. I was so happy after that. It was a really great feeling, great satisfaction.
Greg now has a permanent residency and is on his way to get his citizenship soon. He says he hopes he never has to sit another language test ever again.
Daniel Simo produced that story. The supervising producer was Nina Enova, with help from Alison Chan. What was the first album you bought? Mine was Craig David's Slicker Than Your Average. It wasn't the first song I bought, though. I used to buy singles all the time. And one time, I got banned from playing 50 Cent in the car because I really, really liked Lollipop.
Actually, she means candy shop.
I was some kid. I didn't really know what it meant. My parents' car had the best bass system. It was so good. I would turn it up, put the windows down, sitting in the back seat. And then my parents were like, "Whoa, this is inappropriate for children." On that note, let's check in on some other musical memories.
I had older friends and they were like, "Hey, you should listen to these tracks. Like, we know you really like Deadmau5, but you really like these guys." And I think they just put their headphones in my ears and played the track for me off an iPod Classic. And I was like, "Wow, this is amazing." And then went home to like YouTube it. I'm Alex Clayton. I remember buying Window Lecker in a JB Hi-Fi store in the city with my dad. And for those who don't know the record, the cover is like a Photoshop of Aphex Twin's face on like a bikini model. So it was I don't know, I felt like 13, I was being a bit racy or whatever, and it was a bit cheeky.
The early 90s, when I was transitioning from high school to university, and it was Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit, and it was my very first CD. Hi, I'm Joanna. I worked at the Vic Market selling CDs and other electronics, and that was one of the albums or CDs that was for sale where I worked. So I bought it with my day's earnings, well, part of my day's earnings. They were an up-and-coming band at the time, would you believe? And I just heard their song on the radio, their Smells Like Teen Spirit track, like the key track off the album, and thought, "Oh, these guys sound amazing." So I bought the whole album based on hearing one song.
I think we all went through the, the Neil Diamond era. Now, that was probably, late 60s through to the 70s. He was huge. He was, everybody had his CDs, and Hot August Night, and Live at the Greek, all those things. We all had those, and of course you go to parties or dinners, and everybody be singing. It was Neil Diamond, Neil Diamond, Neil Diamond, and I would even suggest that if you had some sort of a sing along dance night or something like that for people our age, Neil Diamond's his songs. And the Beatles and Elvis Presley, would be it. Because that's what we all grew up with. My name's Alan Sleeves and I live in Ivanhoe. When I was in grade six, I was a good singer. I had a good boy soprano song, and the teacher used to say, "Well, righto, if anybody wants to sing a song, they can get out of school early, you see." And so I sang things like "You Can," John Peel, and a few things like that, and you get out of school early, and you wake up, it didn't mean much because you still had to wait for all your mates to come out of school before you went home anyway. And of course, when your voice breaks, that was the end of my singing career. It was. Haven't been able to hold a note properly since.
My family used to do car trips across Victoria, like when I was in kind of primary school age and stuff, and always used to have something on in the car, like a CD. It was like either like Mike Oldfield's Omadorn, it's like a classic album. And I remember listening to that in the car a lot. It's like a kind of 20-minute, two-side prog rock. There's a lot going on. And then the other thing is Ravi Shankar and Philip Glass, like back-to-back dual-composed album called Bridges, I'm pretty sure it's called. And I love that album so much.
I did like In Excess, heading through the late 80s and Hunters and Collectors and Midnight Oil. That was very much my high school upbringing. And all the high school parties I went to was all that Australian rock music that was very big in the 80s. I went through a really Seattle phase. Like Soundgarden was my A1 favourite band, and Faith No More and all that sort of hard rock, grungy music, that was a big part of the 90s for me. I saw Soundgarden in concert many a time. I walked around dressed in like cords and like op shop cardigans, like like the grunge era. Like that was my wardrobe for 4 years. It was very cheap. I used to know all the words to their songs, by the way, which is hilarious because I really don't listen to any of that music, you know, now, 20 years later.
I think I have like 10 CDs from my adolescence rocking around, like a Vampire Weekend CD and like a So Fresh, you know, compilation.
About the middle 90s, I had a computer import company. I used to spend a lot of time in Hong Kong and over in Taiwan. And I was travelling between a place just out of the capital of Taiwan, and I was going across country to another factory. So, you know, you're trying to have two or three appointments a day. And I was in this car, in this taxi, and the taxi driver put on this CD. In actual fact, it turned out that was a CD called Waiting to Exhale, which had Whitney Houston and a couple of the others in it, Tony Braxton, a few like that. And I thought, oh, that's all right, you know. And I took a bit of a fancy to R&B music from that, and that really exploded things. The 90s, I was really into it. Because you could go into the city and go to the record stores or CD stores, the music stores, whatever you want to call them. But you could go in there and spend an hour or two in some of these stores looking. So if I was looking for the latest Waylon Jennings, or I wanted to find out who else is on R&B or one thing, I could go in there and spend an hour or so in it.
My postgrad was more indie. So indie as in, oh, I used to have posters of the Pixies in my room. I loved the Pixies. I used to go to a lot of nightclubs, indie nightclubs. All that music was, it did take up a bit of my life, but once I went to the UK and started doing more travelling with my studies, and I got more influenced by electronic music, so started moving into listening to Goldie, and that's more drum and bass, and DJ Shadow. I'll hear a track that'll take me back to when I was in the UK the first time Moby's album came out, his first album. So I used to listen to that constantly, and I was also in New York around the same time. And so that whole album just reminds me of being in New York and London. Brings back very fond memories.
I've got my share of classical music. Some I like, some I don't understand. I recall a time when our company was sponsoring the Victorian State Opera. We provided some microcomputers for them. We went and saw at La Boheme, and I remember one night I'm sitting there and it was a bit warm, and I must have nodded off because my wife kept prodding me to stop snoring in the middle of it. We went and saw U2. We had sponsorship arrangement with an organisation that put us all onto U2, and we were in one of those boxes at the tennis centre. None of us of our age knew what the hell was going on, so we just closed the window and sat and had drinks and nibbles for the rest of the night because we didn't understand what U2 are on about. We've always got something on in the car. Probably tends to be the ones we've discovered, if you like, in more recent times.
There's so many really good curators and DJs and stuff in Melbourne who are really good at putting music together. And then it's fun because then you got to discover the song yourself. You have to Shazam it, or you have to like ask on a blog or something. It's like you're the detective or whatever and you're uncovering it rather than someone else is like showing you. That's another way. It's nice, but it's very gratifying to find something for yourself.
Yeah, around 30 and I started working full time. Life got a bit more serious. So that involves more sort of bluesy music and more jazz type music, and probably, yeah, not as hardcore as what I used to listen to. When you're younger, it's such a big part of your life, socialising and music and going and seeing bands, and which I used to do on a very regular basis, on a weekly basis if I could, go and see live music, which is something that I don't do anymore.
Well, the music plays and you display your heart. You go to a funeral, what do you see? A lot of people come in, Many of them are sad, but a lot of them are celebrations now. They're not just sitting there with mournful music. They're celebrating a person's life. And so they'll do have photographs or slideshows of their of the departed person, and they'll have songs to it. And so you'll find a lot of the songs from country and other things in the actual funeral service. So music can go from just a little nursery rhymes when you're born right through to when you're saying goodbye to everybody and you still got music.
That story was by Maddie Twoster. The supervising producer was Jordan Fennell, with help from Alison Chan and Beck Fari. Our next story was told live in the Northern Territory. It's about words in the hearing world, the silent world, and the sign world.
My words, travelling through your ear canals, tickling your eardrums, connecting to three of the smallest bones in your body as they link up to an inner window through a fluid-filled cochlea which spins up to a tip, transferred in an electrical impulse through your auditory nerve up to your brain. And you recognise my words. If anything along that path is interrupted, at most you will hear some noise, and at least you will hear silence. It can be a beautiful thing. Christmas morning, 1990, I woke up to find something stabbing violently on my eardrum. Subsequent evaluation worked out that it was a bug that had crawled in while I was asleep. Being the Australian variety, it didn't want to die very easily, and when dead, it was still annoyed because it didn't want to come out. So I found myself awoke on Christmas afternoon in a sunny ward in Royal Darwin Hospital to Santa stroking my arms, mouthing the words, Merry Christmas. Growing up with hearing loss was not so bad, really. It didn't seem to bother me, just everybody else around me. Angry adults, always shouting. Years later, I said to my mum, why did you always shout at me? Rachel, I'd asked you three times already, she said. You just didn't hear me. And so I used to work out that the key to this sort of hearing lark was watch people's faces, keep abreast of things, try and work out what they were going to say, and don't say yes until you're absolutely certain. But it was a funny sort of world because in one way it was quite solitudinal, and I loved to walk and ramble and think. And on the other hand, I used to really focus hard on people's faces and just automatically seemed to imbibe shape and lip and body movement until I kind of understood what was going on. But your frown on your face and your furrowed brow and your concentrated silent sort of sight, it gave me the personality trait of moody. I wasn't moody. I was just perplexed. I moved on and got various sorts of hearing aids and things like that, and doctors came and went and tut-tutted and had a look, couldn't work it out, syringed them again. I didn't really bother. I wasn't too bothered at all. Had the TV up loud and just enjoyed the quiet, really. But eventually I succumbed and went to school and got called to the principal's office, and an ugly black box was pushed towards me, and he sort of mumbled, go home and wear this. Thank you, I said. I took it home and opened it up, and it was a brown, ugly piece of plastic that I put in my ear, and when I worked out that it hurt, found a million ways to break it. So I managed without managing for another 5 years or so. Eventually I went to college, and by then I'd got two smaller but no less brown hearing aids, which I held in my hands hoping that they would cause magic for my ears to hear. They didn't, but luckily I had a charitable friend who used to lend me her lecture notes, so I scraped by and we headed off to London to the big smoke for our careers in Yuppie Land. I loved London. Nobody talks to you really in London, you know, on the tube or on the street or anything. It's great, you know, just perfect. And I had the added bonus because for some reason, you know, needing a volume-controlled phone, it meant that I was actually one of the 3% disabled. Finally, I had a label, and that meant that everybody wanted to recruit me. Tick. It's great. Never out of work. We should try it here. It'll work, you know. Set it up as a challenge, not as a punishment, you know. We will get in there. But all the graduate lawyers that I sort of was passing through the office in the City of London were all on their gap year, and they were all heading off to Australia, and I thought, hey, it's about my turn. So got my visa, done some sign courses, didn't really want to admit to being in the deaf world, so chose not to. Didn't like the hearing aids, put them at the bottom of the backpack, tried to forget about them, came to Australia. Australia's big. It's wide, it's loud, it's got noisy fans and air conditioning and evening shadowed barbecues. Not really the environment for someone who's deaf. But anyway, I wasn't known for my conversation, but I still managed. So you can imagine that Christmas morning 25 years ago, when I kind of woke up with two bad ears, I went into the operation with two bad, came out with one bad and one not working. I swear to this day that the doctor actually said, "You are going to Alice Springs for an operation." At least that's what I read on his lips. Strange when I arrived in Adelaide. When I was growing up as a child, my cousin and I had learned the fingerspell alphabet. So I was kind of working out, what am I going to do with this? Because by this time I'd had four operations in Darwin, Adelaide, Melbourne. No hearing, just wobbly legs, wobbly balance, and no ability to fly back to England for 1 year. I was stuck here. So I visited the Deafness Association up in Casuarina, and I met somebody there who kind of wanted my skills. Within a couple of weeks, I was teaching lip reading classes, and I was a very quick and visual learner, and so I learned how to sign here. So I didn't really fall into the deaf world, and hearing, I still chose not to wear my hearing aids, but I was able to advocate for people. And so for 12 years, I grew in that role, and I really loved being around people. And of course, technology moves on, and eventually my audiologist gave me these two little bits of brown plastic again, but with a bit of wire attached to them, called a bicross system. So even on your deaf side, you can hear a little bit on your hearing side. And all of a sudden, I had 360-degree sound. It was amazing, really amazing. So I thought, well, I like these, so I will choose. But I still decided that I would be optional as to whether I actually wanted to come out and be deaf, whether I wanted to fight a little bit more and just keep a toehold in that hearing world. But then the motivation for me really to learn to sign came when I had my first child, who was to need speech and sign for the rest of her life. And it was an amazing opportunity. So I had maternal motivation. It makes all the difference. She responded to sign at about 12 months, so I really hassled the family and really made sure more and more people signed to her. And one night she offered up her first sign to me, which was Teddy, given out of the blankets in the quiet and darkness of her bedroom, her forgotten toy that she wanted to sleep with. And my heart sang as I ran to the lounge room to find it. And I realized that I had a connection through our hands. And despite her intellectual disability, she had a brain and we could talk and we could grow and learn together. And she was an amazing pupil. And while she learned to talk and to sign, I learned how to listen. And from that point onwards, my career became going around all over the NT, teaching parents to sign to their children. And I've sat in classrooms and verandas and under trees all over the place and just gently, methodically routinized some sign between a mother and a child and watched the child eventually copy the mother and see how that connection has happened through communication. And I get letters and texts from mum saying, "And he said this and she said that," and it's connection. That's the most amazing privileged role to do. Back here in Darwin, we have grown through my daughter's friends and cousins and teachers sign to connect with each other. And through music, we learn to talk, we learn to read, and we really have learned to grow as a community through signing choirs and performances. It's been an amazing revelation to me. So now I live in three worlds. I live in the hearing world, and I live in the beautiful silent world, and I live in the sign world. And maybe that bug had a purpose after all, because they're all wonderful.
That story was told by Rachel Crowes in 2015. The story producer was Jess Ong. This story was first told at Spun, a live storytelling night presented by Story Projects in Darwin. You can subscribe to the Spun Stories podcast and find out more about the Spun Storytelling Project by visiting spunstories.net or look for them on Facebook and Twitter. One more thing, this really is the last episode of our 2018 season. We'll be taking a break and bringing you more audio by emerging Australian storytellers in the new year. Stay tuned. And while you're waiting, dig into our archive on our podcast or our website, allthebestradio.com. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Will Ryan. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. All the Best Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Erin Dick. Matilda Faye is our social media producer. And I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com and make sure you subscribe to our podcast so you know when we're back in 2019.